All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 8th day of February, 2023. My guests today are Alistair McLeod, he's the head of the Gold Money Research Team at goldmoney.com, and Ewan Downing, he is the CEO of i80 Gold Corp. It's an up-and-coming company, the second largest gold reserve or resource in Nevada, and I think you're going to hear a lot more about I-80. So Ewan will be with me in the second segment of today's show, but right now I'm happy to tell you that Alistair McLeod is with me. I've titled today's show, The Truth About Russia's Golden Ruble and the Dollar's Demise, and that was named after Alistair's recent article, actually January 26 article, it was titled, Russia's Intentions Are Clarifying. Alistair, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, that's very much my pleasure, Jay.
You know, we hear on the news here all the time about how we're sending billions upon billions of dollars over there to the Ukraine to help beat the hell out of the bad guys, the Russians. We're told that it's going pretty well, you know, not only on the battlefield, but also financially, that Vladimir Putin and that country is going to be, if not bombed into the Stone Age, certainly headed in that direction economically. What is your read of the situation over there across the pond? Maybe you have a little different view of things than we do here in America.
Well, I think one thing that is true of all governments is that they bombard us with propaganda. That's true of the Russians. It's true of your government. It's true of my government as well, because they want their narrative to get over. So I'm less concerned with the government narratives. What I try to do as much as possible is source independent information and read hard information when it's available. And when it comes to the war in Ukraine, we are definitely moving towards a new phase in the war. This has been building up. There's been a huge, great argument about making tanks available to the Ukrainians. There was this whole thing about Germany refusing to let tanks, Leopard 2 tanks, be shipped into the Ukraine under license, and indeed for them to provide it. Eventually they caved in. The tanks should be arriving later this month and into March. So you can see that the preparation there for an acceleration of the conflict. And the other thing we need to tie into this was that it's around about this time of the year that the ground is frozen enough to take tank warfare without tanks being bogged down.
Yeah.
And this was Putin's timing last year. He commenced the invasion of Ukraine, I think it was on the 28th of February. So, you know, we're coming up to that time. We need to, I think, step back from this and not sort of think, well, you know, in terms of who's going to win this and all the rest of it. I think as far as we're concerned in financial markets, we're looking at the effect on commodity prices and particularly energy prices of a resumption, if you like, of the conflict over and above what is already happening. What happened last year was that, as you know, the subject, which at Gold Money, we're obviously primarily interested in, the price of gold rose, I think, from something like 1800 to 2070. That was from around about the sort of mid-February to I think around about the 7th or 8th of March when it peaked. Could we have the same sort of thing happening here? Well, and we look at the price of oil, that shot up to $120. And so you can see that this sort of thing is likely to drive a new phase of commodity price rises. I don't think anyone in the markets is really thinking this one through at the moment. I mean, today we've got, for example, we have got Jay Powell is meant to be saying something, I think, literally as this is being recorded. We all hang on his words.
Yeah.
But actually, the more important thing is what the hell is going to happen in Ukraine in a couple of weeks' time. So you can see how, you know, our focus, I think, is being diverted from what really matters. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I can't see that this is not going to escalate. I think it is going to escalate, and we will see a resumption, if you like, in the increase in commodity prices. And the commodity prices are always accommodated by us in the West, by the central banks, ensuring that there is sufficient credit available for us to pay the higher prices.
Right.
That is what is, you know, inflation is in fact a monetary phenomenon rather than a price phenomenon. So the price is the evidence, if you like. So that's the first thing. The second thing, which I don't think anyone is focusing on, is, and this is more to your point, I think, the plans that the Russians have for divorcing themselves even more from our fiat currency system. Now, way back earlier last year, I think it was around about sort of March, April, a guy called Sergei Glazyev, who's one of the senior economic advisors to President Putin, started talking about a new trade settlement currency for the Eurasian Economic Union.
Mm-hmm.
Eurasian Economic Union is Russia, Belarus, and the various stans, if you like. Sorry. I must apologize. I've got a bit of a bad throat.
I feel for you.
Thank you.
I've been
thank
through
you
it. I know what it's like, Alistair. So,
anyway, he was talking about this new currency being a sort of a mixture of the currencies of the countries involved in the Eurasian Economic Union and the commodities that they deal in, and maybe some gold, something like that. It was all a bit airy-fairy. And that is now solidified, and so much so that Glazyev has now obviously decided that gold has got to be central to this currency. So what we're going to see is a trade settlement currency, which is effectively based on gold. Sorry, excuse me. Yeah. Now, this is very, very interesting. And I think the politics behind this is that one of the things that the sort of, if you like, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is jointly run by Russia and China, they've managed to attract the Middle Eastern oil producers into that fold. Some of them are, you know, joining as associate members or dialogue partners or whatever it is. All that's happening, including Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Now, the reason that they're doing this, I think, is twofold. Firstly, we turn around to the Middle East and say, in 10 years' time, we're not going to want your fossil fuels. So tough. Now, that's not a very positive message to give to people who we really do rely on to try and keep things going, if you like, in the way in which we want. I mean, this was the foundation of the petrodollar. So what's happening? They're turning towards Asia. First of all, we see the Qataris having a 27-year contract to supply natural gas to China.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see President Xi being welcomed into Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And Saudis saying we're prepared to accept other currencies, by which they mean trade settlement currencies in Asia. So how is this going to work? Well, in order to attract Saudi Arabia into turning their back on the petrodollar, it's absolutely obvious. They've got to have a better currency to attract them. So the currency basically will be some sort of gold substitute, either that or they will settle balances in gold. Mm-hmm. We've yet to see what this is going to, you know, how this is going to pan out. Mm-hmm. But, sorry, excuse me. But in a message which Glazyev, I mean, he wrote an article in a Moscow business newspaper, which clearly laid out his thinking. And yes, it's gold, gold, gold. Mm-hmm. I could have written it for him. You know, I mean, he was echoing my thoughts, which we've discussed over the years. So it's happening. And I think this is desperately important. So the idea that this conflict in Ukraine is the West's chance to really, if you like, defeat Putin for once and for all, forget it. The real battle is going to be over currencies. Now, the moment that the plans for a gold-linked trade settlement currency, which is bound to be extended into other currencies in that Shanghai Cooperation Union, principally the ruble and also the yuan, the dollar's dead. So is the euro, so is the pound. I mean, it is actually as simple as that. I mean, don't forget that there is huge, huge foreign ownership of the dollar. Those foreigners are going to turn sellers the moment there is a better alternative. What's mm-hmm. that going to do to the dollar? I mean, it's not the dollar against the euro. It's not the dollar's trade weighted we're talking about. It's the dollar versus gold and commodities. And I think this is a point which nobody really fully grasps. The real war between us, if you like, the Western alliance and the Asian hegemons is actually turning out to be financial. Ukraine's a sideshow. I'm sorry that it's such an awful thing for the Ukrainians, but that's the way it is. And I think that's the background really to what we're going to see in 2023.
All right. Well, it's certainly, wishing these things to happen. I think you pointed out, maybe what are some of the reasons why the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and others are interested in exiting the dollar? Do they see the handwriting on the wall in terms of the dollar's future? Are they concerned about the dollar, which is losing its value? Gold, as you pointed out a chart in your in a recent letter in which you showed the price of oil and gold compared to about four or five other currencies. And I mean, oil hasn't gone up at all. It hasn't increased in price relative to gold. I could understand why the Saudis may be happy to have gold replace the dollar for the sale of their oil. But what I guess what I'm getting at is what are the mechanisms in place now to actually make this happen? I think the motive is there. As you say, the United States is giving a signal that we don't want to buy hydrocarbons. We don't want to, fossil fuels or pass. That's certainly not happening in China and India and places like that. Those are countries that I understand are actually getting their oil pretty cheaply now, buying it from Russia. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. And it's sort of turned everything sort of upside down as far as we're concerned, because while we're turning our backs on Russian oil and gas, of course, the Asian countries, and particularly India, are benefiting from substantial discounts. All right. No, I'm very sorry about this.
That's quite all right.
Anyway, so they're getting substantial discounts. And as Glazyev said in his piece for this Russian business newspaper, the new Glencores and Trafigura are going to be China and India. They're the people who are now controlling things like, diesel production and petroleum and all the rest of it coming out of discounted Russian oil. It's a fascinating turnaround. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the other way you need to look at it is that, I mean, their long-term plans in Asia basically are to industrialize the whole of Asia and to create an industrial revolution for roughly 3.8 billion people. And the benefits will also extend to the countries which align themselves mm-hmm. with that enormous, enormous project, right. including the whole of Africa. And look what's going on in South America. I know people have been laughing at this idea that the Brazilians and the Argentinians are going to get together to create a new currency. Because given their track record with currencies, it's a laugh a minute.
Yeah.
But understand why they're doing it. The reason they're doing it is they do need to produce a harder currency in order to trade with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're trying to do. And they will probably back their new currency with gold. They won't offer it to their citizens. Oh, no. You know, citizens, you know, gold is our business, not yours. You can still have the depreciating paper. But you see where this is going to go.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what we're looking at in terms of the global population is the Western Alliance is roughly 1.2 billion people. We're talking mm-hmm. about, you know, the NATO, America, NATO, Five Eyes, throw in Japan and, you know, some of, you know, sort of Southeast Asia, whose alliance to us actually is very, very questionable, but, you know.
Yeah.
So we've got about 1.2 billion people. And, you know, the rest of the world, you've got 3.8 billion Asians already in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. You've got another billion in Africa, so that's 4.8. And you've probably got another, I don't know, thick end of a billion elsewhere, like Latin America and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, and we sort of carry on as if, you know, we are the world. We're not.
No.
You know, and the point asked, you know, about currencies is that quite clearly it's not in Russia and China's interest to use the dollar, which is weaponized against them.
Right.
They want to get out from that. Yeah. Now, so far, I mean, this has been a long running story. So far, they have not taken any proactive steps to get away from the dollar. That is the thing that's changing. So instead of, say, Putin and Xi watching the Americans and the West quietly tie themselves in knots over the currency issue, they are now in a situation where they need to divorce themselves from a collapsing currency regime. And this is why they are now going on to, if you like, the front foot. They're being more aggressive and proactive in terms of creating their own currency environment.
Right. I think you indicated in one of your recent letters that this acceleration of the Ukraine war probably will prompt Putin and the Chinese to be more aggressive in this move away from the dollar towards gold, I believe you said, right? You think yeah. that's probably likely to happen.
Yes, that is definitely the big change that we have seen in 2022. With Glazyev being appointed to head up this new Eurasian Economic Union Currency Committee. And that has evolved now. I mean, he's become so much more involved in Russia's gold as well. He was the leading light behind coordinating this project, the new Moscow Gold Exchange,
mm-hmm.
Allegedly to replace the London Bullion Market Association, which basically has banned anything Russian. as yeah. they were bound to do. So this was officially, that was, if you like, a response to that. But hold on a minute. You know, this is the man designing this new currency. He's heading up this, he's, you know, spearheading this move to create this new Moscow exchange. You know, there are too many coincidences in this, I think. Okay, we haven't had an announcement as to what this currency is yet, but we can see which way this is going. And we don't need to rely on propaganda, Russian or otherwise, to work it out.
So Russia, Moscow's got a gold exchange. I think in Shanghai, they have a futures exchange for oil. They've got a futures exchange, I believe, for gold as well. And, you know, I think you explained in one of your letters that what Saudi Arabia can do is sell their oil to China for yuan, and then instantly take the yuan and trade it in for gold. Is that kind of what's in place? Those mechanisms are in place now, and for trading outside of the SWIFT system too, that the United States has basically blocked Russia from trading in. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have. But I think there is another aspect to this, and that is that there is a difference between you know, trade deficits and surpluses and balance of payments. Now, undoubtedly, the oil revenues that Saudi Arabia will get from China are going to be very substantial. But that is going to be balanced, you know, not by China or whatever coming up with gold or gold substitutes for the Saudis so much, is going to be balanced by inward investment by China into Saudi Arabia. And so this is the way in which the whole thing is going to work. You know, these imbalances in trade are going to be evened out by capital flows. That is the way they're working it. Mm-hmm. And so what you're then looking at is really relatively minor amounts which have to be settled on balance. And, you know, so long as people like the Saudis are, you know, sort of confident that, let's say, out of a dollar equivalent of around about 60 billion, 70 billion trade with China, oil going to China, the inward investment will probably be cover everything but a margin of maybe a couple of billion. Mm-hmm. And they'd probably be quite happy to take a couple of billion in yuan. But mm-hmm. of course, to encourage them to do this, you need to have, you need to be able to say to the Saudis, look, you know, the yuan you're going to get is going to be no worse than the dollars you've been taking. That is the minimum. That is the minimum argument that they can produce. And this is why I think they recognize they've got to get away from this fiat currency situation. And Glazyev said as much too.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, just looking at the United States right now with its enormous deficit that's growing with higher interest rates. I think it was John Hathaway that was wondering recently in an interview, how high do interest rates have to go to clear the market so the Fed doesn't have to monetize? Well, my gosh, it can't go anywhere much higher than it is now before things break down, probably. So I think they're seeing the handwriting on the wall, the Russians, the rest of the world, the Chinese, yeah, for sure. To me, how soon do you think this is going to happen? You know, I had one of the dollar milkshake theory, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the idea that that, you know, whenever the world goes into some kind of a major problem, the dollar gets stronger and money flows into the United States. And that's a sort of counter argument to what you're making in terms of, you know, the dollar losing its value. It seems to me that both of you could be right. It's just that at some point in time, something's going to give, and the dollar is going to give. It may be the last one to go within the alliances, you know, within the major currencies. But eventually, it seems to me that the dollar is going to crash. But the question I have for you then is, what is the timing on this, Alistair?
Well, the timing, I think, is probably not too far away because of the Ukrainian situation. I mean, there's no doubt that we're, you know, within a month, you know, possibly 6 weeks at the outside, you know, the tanks are going to be rolling against each other. And, you know, our newspaper headlines are going to be filled with all the drama that we saw exactly this time last year. And the effect on commodity prices, the gold price and all the rest of it, I think, is rather predictable. Now, under those circumstances, you can see that it would be the moment, as far as Putin is concerned, to maybe open the attack, if you like, on the financial front. Yeah. So I would expect part of his whole armory is to undermine the West's ability to pay for mm-hmm. this Ukrainian war. Mm-hmm. And he's got to be careful how he does it. I mean, there's so many people shouting about, you know, well, this could escalate into a nuclear conflict and all the rest of it. I mean, you've got some real Dr. Strangelove types, it seems to me, you know, in the Pentagon or Washington or whatever. But, you know, I think it seems to me that they are so blinkered that actually, you know, perhaps Putin could open the war on the financial front and catch them all by surprise.
Yes.
I mean, they shouldn't be caught by surprise. It's so damned obvious. But, yeah. You know, it just seems to me, and also, you know, people who are closer to the, if you like, the intelligence establishment, people like Pepe Escobar, for example, who writes about this all the time.
Yes.
I mean, he's, you know, for the last 30, 40 years, he's known people in the Pentagon and, you know, a lot of them are retired, but he gets the feel that these guys haven't got a clue what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that is actually rather worrying. But Putin can use this. He can use this because if they don't expect an attack on the financial front, then, you know, what an opportunity for him. So I think, you know, as to your question, which I've answered in a rather long-winded way, timing, I think let's see what happens with this new escalation, which is now on the cards. I think that might hold the key to it.
Well, there's certainly no doubt that the sanctions, the war in Ukraine, and our response to that war, and an unwillingness to find a solution with Russia, to find a peaceful solution, and then forcing really Russia to do what it's had to do for its own survival, for its own, you know, I mean, we weaponized the dollar, as you say, and that, and he really doesn't have, he doesn't see much choice if he's going to defend his country. I mean, are you worried at all about nuclear war? I mean, is this just so awful that you just put it out of
well,
your mind? It doesn't really matter if we have nuclear war because it's all over, or how would he, because it seems to me a very real possibility. As you say, our people, our intelligence guys can't seem to fathom the idea that the dollar could ever be destroyed. We have these wonderful, you know, these awesome weapons that can go around basically forcing people to do what we want them to do, and, or so it seems. And so, and they've been told, your great economist over there, John Maynard Keynes, who put in the brains of everybody in the West that gold is a barbaric relic and there's no need for it ever to be used again as a monetary metal. So, I mean, this is the indoctrination, isn't it? And this is, why would these guys think? I mean, all these great PhDs out of the most prestigious schools haven't a clue about gold. They don't understand, but they don't really look at the real world and how people think and conduct business, do they?
I think, as to your point about Keynes, I think it's a very good one, because, of course, the Russians were sealed off. Sorry. They were sealed off from this Keynesian revolution. As far as they're concerned, you know, they've got, okay, Marxian economics, but, you know, they never really bought into the idea that gold wasn't money.
Uh-huh.
So you've got this interesting situation, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But I think the information I have suggests that there would be a potential settlement, and there have been attempts to try and start negotiations, which haven't really got anywhere. There would possibly be a settlement from the American side if it was just a question of Russia and China. They could probably stomach that, but the problem is Germany.
Yeah.
NATO was created, in the words of Lord Ismay, who was the first, chairman of NATO or whatever. The purpose of NATO basically is to keep the Americans in, keep the Russians out, and keep the Germans down. And so you can see that, and that's still the situation, because, I mean, you know, the rest of us, well, with few exceptions, are basically now financially based economies or service based economies. We don't make anything anymore.
No,
we give it off to someone else.
That's right.
Germany still manufactures. Its natural economic home actually is part of the whole Asian continent, particularly since it's rapidly industrializing. The economic opportunities for German business are massive. Absolutely massive. They're already aligned with what's going on. They can provide high quality equipment and everything else for that industrial revolution. Yet we're keeping them down.
Mm.
And America in particular, I think, is worried that if it lets China and Russia, sort of do its thing, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, then that is where Germany is naturally going to go. And they do not want that, because then the whole of the Eurasian continent, from Vladivostok all the way to, Cape Trafalgar in Spain, is basically going to be run by them. And and this is something that is in the no-no list as far as Washington is concerned, or as the Pentagon is concerned.
Right. And China has, of course, built up these massive savings of foreign currencies by its net exports, whereas we were on the opposite side of that trade, and they've been able to take that capital that they've earned through producing things and selling it to the rest of the world, and then using that to build this one brick, one road infrastructure that is just amazing. And meanwhile, we're spending all our money and borrowing money to build weapons to try to force people. I think it's, you know, it's obviously empires run their course. Who knows? I don't, as an American, I don't want to see it happen. But what happens is beyond our control. So we have to prepare as best we can, Alistair. So maybe in summary, can you just give a little advice as to what people should be doing? I mean, if the dollar goes down, if what I guess one question I want to ask you, what's the impact? What's the impact going to be in terms of America's markets and our standard of living in the West, the NATO alliances? What's going to happen to us?
Well, the evidence of this will be in rising prices. You'll see, first of all, commodity prices rising. You will see prices of goods in America rising. You will be going into an economic slump while prices continue to rise. I mean, this idea that, only consumers, when you get a slump, it's because consumer demand goes down and the result is that goods become cheaper. That's nonsense.
Yeah.
Well, consumers are producers.
Right.
So, it's not, what happens is that, when you get a reduction in consumption, it's because people are being thrown out of work. Why? Because production is going down. So right. You can see that, this is Say's law. And this is the one thing that Keynes dismissed to make his argument sound reasonable.
Yeah.
Say's law says we produce to consume. So if we're not consuming, why is it? It is because we're not producing. The right. Two things go hand in hand.
Right.
So you're going to see, rising prices, spiraling prices, foreigners selling the dollar. Aren't they stupid? Why should they sell the dollar? And people in America will not realize that what's happening is their currency is collapsing. And then they wake up late. They wake up far too late in the process. And then they just try and get rid of every bit of liquidity they can for goods. That's the crack-up boom. But it always happens this way, Jay. Yeah. The first thing is the foreigners get out of your currency before the domestic, the domestic users suddenly sort of wake up and think, hold on a minute, this is not good. We have been sold a pup by our government. The currency is going down. This is disastrous. What do we do? There's only one thing we can do, and that's just get out of the currency. And that is always, it's foreigners get out first, then, the dawning realization hits people. And, I see the commentary coming out of America. Very, very few Americans seem to understand that the foreigners aren't going to always buy the dollar.
Right.
Not only that, they don't seem to understand that the foreigners are already up to their necks in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
The financial assets, you just look at the US Treasury tick figures, 30 trillion. It's already fallen from 34 trillion financial assets and bank balances. 30 trillion now. A lot of the fall has been portfolio effect. And a lot of the fall from here will also be portfolio effect. But, if you go back to the international forum in St. Petersburg, Putin stood up and told 81 official government delegations. So we're talking about 81 different nations. The dollar is toast. And he said, why? And everybody understood why. They're all primed to sell. It's almost as if Putin can turn around and say, right, now's the time to sell. And that, I think, is a very important point. He's got more power over the dollar than the Fed has, or the US Treasury. This is the reality of the situation, Jay. Not, the world needs reserve dollars. Oh, and that's another thing. This whole idea of fiat currencies and, official reserves and all the rest of it, that's out of the window. That's yesterday's story.
Yeah.
Central banks in future will not have currency reserves. There's no point. I mean, a little bit for liquidity purposes, but the idea that, coordinated interventions in order to support your currency or whatever, that's dead. That's gone. And this is another thing which I think very few people realize.
No, there's no talk of that here. And that's to your point that the real war is is not the war on the battlefield. As awful as that is and as unfortunate as that is, the real war is a financial war. It's a financial markets, an economic war. I mean, Jim Rickards and a few people here and there, you named one a little bit ago, intelligence people, Pepe, I think, that you mentioned. A few understand it, but most don't. And certainly the commentary doesn't even get close to it. Even the more conservative news networks here don't seem to have a clue about it, because we've all been really educated not to think in terms of what money really is. And as you pointed out, only gold is money. Everything else is a liability, is debt. I think it was you, maybe it was JP Morgan. I don't know if I give you credit for it, Alistair, if it was JP Morgan, but somebody brilliant. And I thought about that and I said, wait a minute, I'm using all kinds of things other than gold for money. How can you say that? But then when you think about it, maybe you can make a case for silver. They're both assets, asset-based money. Everything else is credit. So I want to thank you so much, Alistair, for putting up with me and talking to me, to our viewers all this time. Especially thank you because of today's, I know what it's like when you have a cold and you have to talk. It's not fun, but you really were a trooper. You put up with it. So thank you so much for being with us again, Alistair.
Well, that's very kind of you, Jay, and thank you very much for asking me.
Well, thank you. Well, that is all for this segment. That's all the time we have for this segment. If you've enjoyed this video, make sure that you hit the like button and subscribe to this channel. Don't go away now, because you and Downing will be with me in just a couple of moments. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm pleased to have Ewan Downing. He's the CEO of i80 Gold Corp with me today. Ewan has been a very successful mining entrepreneur and has won a lot of awards in Canada for his achievements over the years. Well, you just heard from Alistair MacLeod. He explained why the days of dollar hegemony appear to be nearing an end. If Alistair's thesis is correct, then gold and gold shares, at least those of efficient gold miners, should do very well in the years to come. i80 Gold Corp is a relatively new name in the gold space, but it is a company that I believe you will soon become, you're going to hear a lot about them. They'll become a household name, in my view. i80 already holds the second largest gold resource in Nevada behind Barrick and Newmont joint venture, Nevada Gold. As a disclaimer, I should tell you that i80 is a recommendation in my newsletter. It is personally my largest holding at this point in time, at least, and it is a sponsor for today's show. For that, we're very glad to tell you that Ewan is with us. Before I say hello to Ewan, I should probably tell you i80 trades in the United States and in Canada. 246 million shares, been trading around $2.60, $2.70, somewhere in that range in US money. Giving it a market cap of around $650 million. Ewan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, Jay.
Yeah, the last time we talked on Turning Hard Times into Good Times, you were the president and CEO of Premier Gold Mines, which has metamorphosed into i80 Gold Corp. Can you share with our listeners and our viewers the story of Premier and evolving into i80?
Yeah, Premier was a gold-focused company that had projects and mines in Canada, the United States, in Nevada, and in Mexico. And our largest project in the portfolio of Premier was the Greenstone mine property. And in 2021, Premier was acquired by Equinox Gold. The key asset that they were seeking to acquire was the Greenstone asset that is currently in construction. And that is a deposit that essentially was a discovery of ours at Premier. We drilled out a large open pit, similar to sort of an Osisko type open pit, and it is now in construction and will be in production next year. But as part of that takeover, we spun out the Nevada assets to create i80 Gold. And i80, since inception, less than 2 years ago, we have made numerous key acquisitions that, as you said, make us the largest holder of gold and silver resources in the Carlin and Battle Mountain trends next to Nevada Gold Mines. And our growth trajectory over the next several years, we expect to soon become the second largest producer of precious metals in the state.
The second largest producer, and you are, as I say, the second largest, I think, resource right now in the state. Could you talk a little bit about that resource? How many ounces of gold and other metals might you have at this stage?
Is approximately 6.5 million ounces in indicated category and over 8 million ounces inferreds for a total of over 14.5 million ounces of gold. Mm-hmm. And that is spread out across three different projects. We are four different projects. We are currently upgrading two additional deposits to resource. So we've in 2022, we had a very significant exploration campaign at numerous projects, had numerous successes, and we are expecting to add to our gold and silver endowment in the coming year as we release new resource estimates. We also have started production at our Granite Creek operation. So we have a small scale production this year, gearing up to be much larger production in 24, 25, and then 26 as we build out our multiple assets. We're also quite blessed to have significant infrastructure in the state. We have two existing processing facilities that make the transition from explorer to developer and producer much more realistic, since we don't have to permit. And as you know, permitting new mining and tailings facility is one of the biggest challenges for operations. So we're quite blessed with infrastructure and resources.
Right. So the names that I'm familiar with as I watch what you're doing are Ruby Hill, which is, I guess, I consider it seems to me that the flagship of your company. You're extremely exciting. It's not only gold and silver, but you also have a carbonate replacement discovery that is really an exciting story of, I guess it's silver, lead, and zinc there, probably, at Ruby Hill?
Yeah, it's primarily lead, zinc, silver, but we are getting up to 60 grams gold with those intercepts too. So we're getting extremely high-grade gold mineralization. And we are, the gold deposit we have there is a Ruby Deeps. And that was the focus of our early exploration at Ruby Hill, was defining the Ruby Deeps deposit for underground development. We've submitted our permits to go underground. We expect to start the development of the underground workings here later this year. But after we delineated what we feel is a mineable resource at the Ruby Deeps deposit, we embarked on exploration. And the thing about the Ruby Hill district, or the Eureka district as it's called, is the history in mining for the first 100 years of production in this district was all CRD. 102 years. It was 1864 to 1966. And after 1966, the district went more or less dormant until Homestake and Barrick came along looking for Carlin-type deposits. But and they essentially ignored the CRD opportunity. But the historic CRD mines that mined here are amongst, if not the highest grade CRD deposits of this type that you'll find anywhere in the world. And in the second half of last year, we started looking at the CRD targets as an exploration focus for the second half of the year. And our first three targets resulted in new discoveries. We're drilling those deposits, or what we think are becoming deposits, out as we speak. Our exploration was supposed to slow down quite a bit in 2023, but at Ruby Hill, but instead we've ramped up to have six drills active, and we have a few exciting new targets that we'll be testing early in this year's program that we feel have a good opportunity to be at other CRD deposits. So we're having a lot of success. The upper hilltop zone that we discovered, in my opinion, is probably the highest grade deposit in the metal space that was discovered anywhere in the world in 2022. So we're pretty happy about what we're doing there. We keep stepping out, we're testing new targets, and we think this year is going to be a huge year for our company, primarily on this polymetallic mineralization that includes lead and zinc. So it also gives our company significant diversification in metals.
Yeah, it sure does. And that kind of makes sense, because I think Nevada was known as the silver state. That may even be its model. And that came from those carbonate replacement deposits, CRDs, as you call them, for the sake of people who may not be familiar with the nomenclature. You heard Ewan talk about CRD deposits. That's what he's talking about at Ruby Hill. That is the hilltop zone. And very exciting. And I think you mentioned before we started recording today that that zinc is now a metal of interest, a special interest to the United States government. It's considered a critical metal. Is that, do I have that right?
Yeah, in late 2021, the U.S. Geological Survey added two new metals to their critical minerals list. And those two metals were nickel and zinc, not copper. Mm-hmm. As you know, there's quite a bit of copper production in coming out of Arizona. So I would say that there's quite a bit of copper mining taking place in the United States. But over the last couple of decades, we've seen no new zinc mines put in production in the United States. Hmm. And in fact, multiple zinc mines have shut down, including one last year that Teck operated in Washington. So zinc is, I think, becoming more important to the U.S. as a metal because there isn't much at-home production right now in terms of the metal. Mm-hmm. And with the political issues we're seeing, so to speak, with Russia and China and some of the challenges they're having, I believe that the make your metals, make your product at home is going to be more and more a focus for the United States going forward. And we just happen to have made what we think is one of the most significant zinc or discoveries that includes mm-hmm. zinc made since the Arizona mining discovery, the Taylor deposit in Arizona. So we're quite excited by the fact that we have what appears to be a very significant zinc deposit we're drilling out right beside one of the highest grade undeveloped gold deposits in the United States.
Is there some sense of when you might be able to get some production from Ruby Hill?
We expect to see some production from the gold side because mm-hmm. we have a processing arrangement with Nevada Gold Mines while we start our facilities. So it allows us to start mining sooner than we would if we were waiting to get our facilities running. And I would expect in 2024 in the 426 zone, which is one of the gold zones, we will start to get into some of the ore production there, and that will be gold production in this initially. But in 2024, we also intend to drive our underground infrastructure over to the Blackjack deposit. Mm-hmm. That's the largest of our known base metal projects or polymetallic projects to date. And we expect to do an underground drill program to define that for development. So it's quite possible if the permitting lines up, that we could move into polymetallic production in 25 or 26.
Oh.
And in addition to being a gold producer.
Can you give us some sense of the economics that I don't know how much of this you can talk about yet. And I think you're probably doing some feasibility work on this project as well as others. But can you give us a sense of what, you know, you're talking about some incredibly high grades. I know the Ruby Deep was really phenomenal. Those grades, those intercepts were very exciting. But can you give us some sort of a sense of what the economics might look like, starting with the gold project?
Yeah, the gold projects, the three deposits we're developing are Cove, Granite Creek, right. and Ruby Deeps at Ruby Hill. Granite Creek average grade is over 10 grams per ton. The Cove project is almost 11 grams per ton. Those are both in development with some mining just starting at Granite Creek. So those projects are both underground. We're preparing those for long-term mining. And then Ruby Hill, we expect the grade to be somewhat lower, probably in the 7 to 8 gram range. But the widths are significantly bigger, so the mining cost should be less. Mm-hmm. So we're going through. We've released two preliminary economic assessments that demonstrate very strong returns for the Cove and Granite Creek projects. We're working on one as we speak for the gold side of Ruby Hill. And the drilling we're doing right now is bringing the polymetallic or the zinc, lead, gold, silver deposits to 43-101 resource so that we can start working towards an economic study that we can actually publish for that project, hopefully as early as sometime in 2024. Mm-hmm. And as we're developing our projects, we'll be really looking at, because we have the two processing plants, one that we expect will process base metals. That's the plant at Ruby Hill. Long term, we want to convert that to a flotation plant that produces a lead and a zinc concentrate. And all of the gold mineralization will be trucked to Lone Tree from the three sites to our central processing autoclave. We're one of the only we're one of three companies in all of the United States that has a facility like this for processing refractory ore. So we need to get all three underground mines operating in order to fill that autoclave. And the base metal side, I just say in terms of economics, if you look at the grades that we're drilling in the upper hilltop, they are on a dollar equivalent multiples of any of our gold deposits. So I'm expecting that once we do publish the economics, it'll be a real eye opener.
It's really exciting. I think that, you know, that facility that you have there at the Lone Star facility, which is you're sort of a hub and spokes model, business model then, I guess, isn't it, Ewan?
Yeah, I'd say in some ways, if you look at how Nevada Gold Mines is in production, and for those who don't know, Nevada Gold Mines is the joint venture where Newmont and Barrick put all of their gold assets in Nevada together. And collectively, Nevada Gold Mines, if it were its own mining company, would be the fourth largest producer of gold in the world annually. Mm-hmm. Only its two owners and Agnico Eagle produce more gold than Nevada Gold Mines. So it's huge production, but they have a hub and spoke model at three different sites. So at Turquoise Ridge, they have a central processing facility fed by multiple deposits. At Cortez, they have a processing facility fed by, I think, four deposits. And then at Goldstrike in the Carlin Trend, they have two processing facilities fed by about 12 different operations. So we're doing exactly what Nevada Gold Mines is doing with the Lone Tree autoclave, but we're feeding it with three deposits. So we're doing it on a smaller scale than them. Mm-hmm. But in saying that, we also have the polymetallics and the processing facility at Ruby Hill. So that project would be centrally located. So the deposit that we expect to mine there is right beside the processing facility. So it's Lone Tree would be a hub and spoke for the gold operations, but we expect that Ruby Hill is going to be just one deposit, one mine.
Yeah, those sort of complex ores are fairly common in Nevada. Do you see any possibility of using that facility to process ores from other companies? Is that a toll milling or anything? You're hoping not to, probably. You want to
our
grade stuff through there. Yeah.
Yeah. Our hope is that our three projects, we can mine ultimately sufficient ore that we fill that facility for the long term. But that said, if we do find that there is capacity, for sure we would consider bringing in third-party ore, or maybe even discussing with Nevada Gold Mines if they had some material that they needed to be processed, even working with them. So I think we're quite open to being remaining friendly with Nevada Gold Mines in the state, and obviously keep our options open as we build our company.
But just looking at your latest financials over the 9 months ending in the first 9 months of 2022, you had an operating profit, even though you had a very small, I think 13,000 ounces or something like that, $7 million operating profit, but you showed a loss of, I think, $41 million or something, but you included there, because you Canadians, I guess, include their exploration expenses of something like $32 million, and, well, general administrative costs, of course, come out of it, but do you see a time? I mean, when do you think you might be able to see a positive number on the bottom line? Do you have any goal for that? Any idea what you might what investors might look forward to?
2023 is a big development year for our company, so sure. We haven't started the underground development yet at Ruby Hill. So I'd expect 23 to be smaller production, more development heavy. In 24. It is our goal to start mining both some of the upper part of the gold deposit at Ruby Hill. So that would make two of our underground mines doing smaller scale production in 24. And depending on the infrastructure build outs on either the base metal or the gold side, I wouldn't really expect us to start demonstrating any types of positive cash flow on the bottom line to probably at least 25 and possibly even into 26. But beyond that, we should have a good runway for at least a couple of decades of very strong production. And as I said, we do intend over the next 3 to 4 years to become the second largest gold producer in the United States, which is a pretty lofty goal, but we do have the resources to do it. Yeah. We have the infrastructure already in place. We have grid power. We've got water rights. We've got road access. We've got all of the infrastructure there to do, to carry out our goal. Now it's just doing all the prudent economic work, drill out the deposits properly, get the proper mining methods implied through probably bulk sampling at each project, and then really moving forward with our growth and production. But in the meantime, we do expect to have some very significant exploration results. This is going to be our biggest year of pure exploration, so testing new targets in our company's young life. But we are expecting that some of those could yield some pretty significant additional discoveries, even though we think we've made some of the top discoveries anywhere in the world in the last 12 months.
I think there's no doubt about that. Well, investors should realize that it's not, for a company like yours, as you're building wealth in the ground, you're building up shareholder value, and that will be reflected in the price of the shares, which are now around $2.60 or so, $2 in U.S. money. It's my largest holding at this stage. I have a lot of confidence. Ewan has had, you've had a lot of success in the past. You have the operating people, the people that can put these mines into production. So I have a high level of confidence. Your balance sheet is pretty clean. I believe you're pretty well off financially now. You have a good amount of cash on the balance sheet, Ewan?
Yeah, at the end of Q3, we had a very strong balance sheet. At the end of Q4, pretty decent balance sheet as well. But we do have a lot of development initiatives underway. So, you know, there is, I would expect over the next probably 18 months, you'll see some financings done, be it debt, be it additional prepays or streams or equity or converts. We're looking at all type of options. But the next couple of years are pretty development heavy and capital intensive, but I am one of the company's largest shareholders, so I'm very cognizant of share dilution. Sort of have a goal in mind of how many shares we want to have out ultimately when we start producing, because we believe we'll have created a company that will trade with a market cap in the billions. And if we can do that with somewhere around 300 million shares, that would result in the share price being, in our opinion, close to $10. And mm-hmm. So I think that's our goal of how we want to finance our growth, bring our projects to feasibility so that we could take on debt financing or put mm-hmm. a revolver in place, et cetera, like all the big mining companies sure. have, mm-hmm. and just set ourselves up better financially to be a significant producer.
Ewan, I think you said you're one of the largest shareholders. You have some other large shareholders, corporate interest as well. I believe Equinox, perhaps?
Yeah, Equinox, who acquired Premier, owns between 20 and 25% now. Mm-hmm. Orion Mine Finance, who has been a big source of the capital we have to date, they've been, and they were a big supporter of Premier prior to us being taken over financially to build that business. They are, I believe, our second largest shareholder. And the large financing we did last year was entirely with Orion. And we are continuing to discuss with Orion additional funding that we will require as we build out our company. And it's a relationship we've had for several years with one of the biggest financiers of the mining business. And we really appreciate that relationship, and we really work hard to incubate it.
Well, that's good. There's another company I suspect is probably buying your shares on the market. I don't know that for sure, but it's Crescat Capital Corp. I know that Quentin Henning, who I know very well, is extremely bullish on your CRD deposit and can't say enough good about it, at least when I see his videos that he records with Crescat. So I'm sure there's a great project, you won't have problems financing. Of course, we'd like to see you do it at higher levels than the current level, that's for sure. But I do think it's a great time for people to get into, or at least to take a look at your story. Ewan, I want to thank you so much for spending time to inform people of i80 Gold. It's a great story, and we'll look to keep up with it in the future. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us on. And I think the timing's great because 2023, in my view, is going to see all-time highs in the gold price. So we're quite excited by what this year has to bring for our company and for other gold companies as well.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. There may be some other things in the world that aren't as pleasant, but I think gold probably will be the recipient of some of those other things that are going on that may not be the best, but it is what it is. And that's why those of us who own gold, it's not because we want to get rich owning gold, but we know the world is a place in which it's imperfect. And this is one of the best ways, I think, financially to protect your interests going forward. Well, folks, that is all the time that we have for this week. I want you to remember, if you like this video, to hit the like button and also sign up to subscribe to this channel. Next week, Michael Oliver will be with me once again. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.